but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. Over the course of the last 8 years producing American Warrior Radio, we've had a number of special operators on the show. By my count, 9 of them were Navy SEALs. Now, when I first became friends with one of our local Navy SEALs, the owner of my favorite local pub, it wasn't long before I became the butt end of his somewhat cutting sense of humor and good-natured jokes. Now, I'm not one that gets offended easily, but it made a fellow wonder, was it just me? So I asked around and eventually was enlightened to a tidbit of wisdom. In that community, a group well known for their gallows humor, if they're not busting your chops regularly, then they don't really like you. So I accepted that as a compliment and started giving as good as I got. Today, I'm going to test the boundaries of that theory. Wish me luck. Given the scientifically accurate sample rate of former Special Forces members that have been on the show and some of their endeavors after leaving the service, I have developed a must-do punch list for the special operator community after they leave the service. Let's grade today's guests. Make a T-shirt. Check. Write a book. Check. 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 Start a successful post-service business in your garage. I'll give them half a point. Start a roasted coffee line. Have one of your books made into a major screen production starring one of Hollywood's most in-demand lead actors. Well, that is what puts today's guest into the bonus round. Our guest today served at the tip of the spear for 20 years. He transitioned from an enlisted Navy SEAL sniper to a junior officer leading assault and sniper teams in Iraq and Afghanistan. He then moved on to platoon commander conducting counterinsurgency operations in the southern Philippines, and then commanded a special operations task unit in the most Iranian-influenced section of southern Iraq during the drawdown of U.S. forces. And still no coffee company. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, New York Times and USA Today best-selling author, Jack Carr.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
Well, of course. I appreciate you agreeing not to release your latest work, The Devil's Hand, until you could appear on American Warrior Radio, Jack.
That's what I was waiting on, so I sincerely appreciate it.
That's my story, and I'm sticking with it. Now, Jack, regular listeners know that BBG only has two steadfast rules. We avoid political talk, and I insist on reading an author's work before they come on the show, but I confess I've only read The Terminal List so far. So today I'm going to attack your flanks. I don't want to talk so much about James Reese as I want to talk about Jack Carr. Fair enough?
All right, let's do it. Let's do it.
Okay, I've heard you say that we're all forged into who we are over time. Now, if that's true, you must have had a hand on the blacksmith's hammer your whole life. You knew you wanted to be a Navy SEAL and a successful writer at the ripe old age of 7.
That's right, that's right. So, yeah, there's two callings. Like, I look at what I've done, really. It's a profession of arms, not the career of arms. And I look at writing as a profession as well, not necessarily a career. And I just didn't get discouraged along that path. You know, when you tell somebody when you're a little kid you want to be an astronaut or, you know, a firefighter or a police officer or whatever it is, they kind of look at you with those eyes saying, he'll grow out of it, you know, that sort of a thing. And I just never grew out of it. I just wanted to serve my country in uniform from the earliest of days. And so I started training for it back then. I started researching back then. My mom was a librarian, so we spent a lot of time at the local library, and I grew up with this love of reading and books. And so by the time I got to about age 10, when I started to read the things my parents were reading, that's when Hunt for Red October came out, and I just fell in love with the written word, particularly these thrillers written by Tom Clancy and Nelson DeMille and David Morrell and A.J. Quinnell and J.C. Pollock and Mark Holden and Stephen Hunter and all these guys who had protagonists with backgrounds that I wanted in real life one day. So typically back then they had SEALs or Army Special Forces guys or CIA operatives that had Vietnam experience, and I wanted that. As well, I wanted to be a Navy SEAL as soon as I saw that movie, The Frogman, and I wanted to join the military even before that. And that's when, because my grandfather was killed in World War II, and so I grew up with pictures of him and his squadron, his medals, his wings. He flew the Corsair, which is the plane that had the gold wings that would fold up to fit it on an aircraft carrier.
Sure.
So I grew up with those, and I just knew I wanted to serve my country in uniform like he did.
So he was a Marine then.
That's right. That's right. And so there was a show, Black Sheep Squadron, on TV growing up. I think I missed it when it actually came on in the late 70s, but I caught it in syndication in the early 80s. So I got to watch that show where Robert Conrad plays Happy Boynton, and of course they fly the Corsair. So I had a connection to my grandfather through watching that show with my dad.
Maybe the most accurate TV series ever.
Okay.
It was fun, though. I'm with you. I watched it quite a bit. Now, one thing interesting about you, Jack, and with all due deference, sir, it's not hard to find a Navy SEAL who's written a book or two. But what I find
they teach it in Bud Thursday.
Right. Ring the bell, don't get to write a book. One thing about you, though, I find interesting, Jack, is you were 20 years at the tip of the spear. But you no longer identify as a SEAL. You now identify as a writer who was a SEAL. And some of your comrades don't have as easy of a time leaving that behind. Would that be an accurate summation?
Yeah, I saw as I was getting ready to get out that I saw a few people transition. And I saw a lot of them have a hard time leaving the life behind. And I saw a lot of them try to recreate what they had in the SEAL teams. On the outside in the private sector. So for me, I was lucky in that I knew exactly what I wanted to do next. And I also knew how important it was to build from a foundation and not stay in the past and stay living in those years that we had in the SEAL team. So that was one chapter in life upon which to build. And then it was time to turn that page and move forward. But build just like anything else, it doesn't have to be the military or SEAL teams. It can be any transition in life. It's building on that foundation, taking those lessons learned, moving forward. So I just identified that and decided, I'm going to flip that page. And now, being a SEAL is something that I was and something I did. It'll always be a very big part of me. But at the same time, it's now time to move on and take care of my family and follow this next passion for writing. So that's what I did. We even made a psychological and physical break with the military by leaving Coronado, California, and moving up to the mountains in Park City, Utah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I saw an interview you did where you don't want your kids going to the school that the kids of other Navy SEAL families are going to. I mean, it's a complete...
It was more of just being in the same area, seeing the same people, going to the same bars, the same grocery stores, all that sort of thing. And Coronado, California was great to us, but it was time to turn that page, so excited to physically leave that area.
Now, Jack, you enlisted. You began as an enlisted sailor. You rose to the rank of lieutenant commander, which for our listeners from other branches listening would be the equivalent of major, if I'm not mistaken. But it's interesting. You said you started to miss not being able to be out there kicking in doors anymore, and it struck me. We have our own submarine, the USS Tucson. And some of the captains of those ships, mostly lieutenant commander rank, some of them, it's almost like they didn't want to get promoted because they didn't want to not be out there going places they're not supposed to and hunting bad guys at the same time. Is that sort of the vibe you were getting towards the end of your career, too?
Well, that's right. That's why I wanted to come in enlisted, because I knew that would extend my operational time. I also, it's also the influence of popular culture in that growing up in the 80s, it seemed like every TV show or every movie about Vietnam, they'd always have this brand new officer that would show up and make everybody get haircuts and shave and stretch their uniforms and start saluting, and then he'd lead them right into an ambush. That was like the MO for all 80s Vietnam movies. And so I knew I didn't want to be that guy. I wanted to learn the trade, establish a reputation. I wanted to be a sniper. Typically, officers aren't snipers. So I came in enlisted, and then eventually at a 6.5-year mark, went to OCS, became an officer, and went right back to the SEAL teams. And then at that major rank, that lieutenant commander rank, where I was a task unit commander, at the end there, that would be the last time that I would tactically maneuver guys on the battlefield. After that, if I stayed in, then you come back as a commanding officer, which sounds impressive, but really, what you're doing, you're more of a manager at that point. You're not going out with the guys. You're not kicking in doors. You're not tactically maneuvering guys on the battlefield. You're back in that tactical operations center, allocating assets and that sort of thing. So plus I picked my head up and saw my family needed me, and it was time to move on. So it was a good solid run, but it's in the past now.
Outstanding. Ladies and gentlemen, he's published 4 thrillers. The latest, The Devil's Hand, should be on the shelves of your local bookstore when you're hearing this broadcast. You can learn more. Visit www.officialjackcarr.com. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. What a pleasure to be talking with Jack Carr, the man. You can find out more, officialjackcarr.com. Carr is spelled C-A-R-R. Jack, your mom, you mentioned, was a librarian. My mother was an English teacher. We didn't have a television until, gosh, I was maybe 9 or 10 years old, so we read everything we could get our hands on. And you also, apparently you learned to write by reading. Make
That's
sense?
That's right. Yeah, I grew up, I was surrounded by these books and a love of reading. And I think the only reason we had a TV in our house is so that my dad could watch football. But without without that, that's one thing he put his foot down there. We're having this so he can watch his football. Otherwise, my mom would have not had a TV in the home growing up. But, just grew up with this love of reading and books. And if I showed an interest in something, she would take me down to the local library and take that as an opportunity to research. And that's what we did with SEAL Team. When I found out that what frogmen were through this old black and white film I saw with my dad, that I asked him what frogmen were, and he said, ask your mother. So we went down to the local library and found out that frogmen were, found out about the SEAL teams and underwater demolition teams. And my takeaway from that research is that training is some of the toughest ever devised by a modern military, and these are some of the most elite special operations forces on the planet. So I found that out at age 7, and they had me ever since. So the recruiter's job was very easy.
Yeah, it sounds like you should send him a free copy of a book, maybe, if you can track him or her down. Now, I tell you, Zach, I do read a lot, not just because I enjoy it, but also, you know, obviously we have to read to prepare for the show. And I really, honestly, I really enjoyed the Terminal List, and I liked it because the chapters were short. And I'm not a lazy reader, but some authors that seem to write, Jack, like it's a high school English paper and they're getting paid by the word. It strikes me that you write like a Navy SEAL moves. Everything is efficient and with purpose. It's descriptive, it's vivid and concise, but it makes for a more enjoyable read.
Oh, thank you. It wasn't really by design. I just did what came naturally. So by reading all those people that I read growing up, what I was doing, and I didn't realize it at the time, but what I was really doing was giving myself an early education in the art of storytelling. And I only realized that looking back, because at the time I was just enjoying it. I was reading those authors, and then I was reading all the nonfiction I could possibly find on warfare and terrorism and insurgencies and counterinsurgencies. Some of my earliest memories are of seeing U.S. citizens being taken out of the embassy in Iran in blindfolds, and Walter Cronkite counting down the days that they'd been held hostage. Of course, I'm seeing Time and Newsweek and our newspaper headlines with the Marine Barracks bombing in the early 80s, and then TWA 847, and later on 103. So all those events were very impactful to me growing up, because I'm from about age 7, let's say age 18, was a very, very impactful time for me. So I was always studying those things, always reading. And my mom also introduced me to Joseph Campbell through a series of interviews he did with Bill Moyers in 1988 called The Power of Myth. And I discovered his book, Hero with a Thousand Faces, and read that. And then I think I just applied that to everything I read or watched on TV or movie ever since. And what he did was study mythologies from cultures that had never had any interaction and found that they all had a very similar hero's journey. And so I've just incorporated that into my writing as well. But the short chapters were not by design. They were just it was just telling the story, and some are longer than others, but it was just what came naturally as I wrote.
Well, it works. So real quick question. I mean, people, in order to get to know James Reese, your main character, folks need to buy the books and read them. But I'm curious, Jack, I kind of picture you in this forward operating base in a ditch somewhere with a lead pencil and a napkin, you know, starting to write the Terminal List. Where did James Reese come from? Is that name an homage to some folks you knew? Was that your grandfather's name was Jim, maybe? Or where did that name come from?
Yeah, so it is personal, and I keep it close hold exactly where it came from. But yeah, when I was downrange, really, I was always reading, and that was my responsibility as a leader to understand the nature of the conflict in which we're engaged. So I'm always studying the politics of the region, even the economy of the region, obviously the enemy, their tactics, how those are evolving, how they've been adapting over the years. So I'm always studying all of those things, and then I would always be reading those same authors that I read growing up as well, because a lot of them are still writing today. So I didn't watch too many movies, but I wasn't writing or thinking about. I knew that I was going to write, but I didn't know. I didn't do that while I was in. I didn't do that while I was downrange. But when I got back from my last deployment and I decided to get out and I dropped my papers, and then I went into that other pile. For those who have been in the military, know that you have to go through this gigantic bureaucracy in which you have to navigate through to get out of the military. So you have to go to medical and dental and get read out of secret programs and turn in gear. You have to make appointments for all these things, and you have to stand in line, then you have to follow up. So it takes a little while, and that gave me some time to start writing. So I sat down and started to do that during about my last year and a half in the teams, when I wasn't responsible for taking anybody downrange anymore.
Now, you've been to lots of exotic locales, but one thing that I like and some of the other reviewers like about your books, Jack, is you do extensive research, even to the extent of, you know, taking some time and going to that highly popular summer vacation destination of Kamchatka Peninsula.
That's right. So for the first book, I'd been to Iraq, I'd been to Afghanistan, I'd been to most every place that I write about in that first novel. The second one, I hadn't been to Mozambique, so I went to Mozambique, put boots on the ground there. I just wanted to weave that local flavor into the pages of the novel. And then as I was finishing that one up, I went to South Africa to help train up an anti-poaching unit that was switching over to Glocks and M4s, to platforms with which I have some experience. So went down there, learned a ton from them about tactical tracking, and got to weave some of that into both the second and the third novels. And then for that third one, Savage Sun, a lot of the action takes place in Kamchatka, Russia, just south of Siberia. So I knew I had to put boots on the ground there because it was such an important location. So flew over there, left my computer and my phone behind because I didn't want the Russian intelligence services to either confiscate those or suck out all the information as I passed through customs. So I brought my notepad and a sat phone to check in with the home front, and I outlined the fourth novel on that trip. I got to weave all of that when I got home into Savage Sun, and then start the research for this fourth one, The Devil's Hand.
Now, I'm curious. So, even given what you did, Jack, and the level that you did it, there's no travel limitations. I mean, do you have to check with someone before you leave the country just to be safe? Or
not anymore?
Okay.
Nope, not anymore. Go ahead. I'm free. I'm finally free.
Okay. So, one of those exotic locales. I've heard rumors, and I will get through all your books, I promise, because that's respectful, but also I like him, and that's how you make money. But was there ever a reference to that exotic locale, the Trident Grill?
Yeah, there was. There's one in there, and I forget which book I put that in, but there is. So I've been there, and it is obviously, has that name, I think, for a reason. So
yeah.
So absolutely, give a little nod to that place for sure.
I
forget which novel it was, though. They're all kind of blending together now that my mind's on book five, which I'm writing right now as I launch book four. So it's in there. It's either in the, I think it's in the second or the third one. I can't remember which.
I'll find it. But Nelson sends his greetings and his appreciation to you.
Thank you so much. Love that place.
Good,
yeah, it's an amazing place.
Now, one other thing, the feelings in your book come from a real place. You've been there, you've done that, you've experienced it. And I've heard you say that that's maybe part of the reason your book made the first cut with the publishers. But I do notice, at least in the terminal list, there's a lot of anger in that book. Are you kind of venting, getting some stuff off your chest there?
That's right. It was very therapeutic to write that. And I didn't really anticipate that at the outset. I thought I was just going to sit down and, write a good book that would be an escape for people that were going on vacation or something like that. But then as I started to write, it became evident immediately that a lot of my own personal experience would be woven in there. And, some of that is frustration with senior level leaders and the amount of time, energy, and effort they put into studying the nature of the conflict in which we're engaged. And some of those decisions had dire consequences for servicemen and women on the battlefield. So I don't spare them in the novel, that's for sure.
Now, I read more nonfiction than fiction, Jack, but there's a lot to be learned from reading fiction as well. I mean, has it been your experience, or do you write to the extent where somewhat art imitates life?
I do, because I learned so much from the pages of thrillers growing up. And back then, of course, there was no internet, so you couldn't just, you know, put in Special Activities Division, or you couldn't just put in Navy SEAL or that sort of thing and get a whole bunch of information and go down the rabbit hole. You had to go to the library. You had to put in that effort. You had to go to a bookstore. You had to get a magazine and read an article, and then you couldn't just do a word search for something in a book or a magazine or a newspaper. So you had to put in that work. And authors who were writing about people that had backgrounds that I wanted one day had to do research as well. So I learned a ton from the pages of thrillers growing up. So I think it's very natural for me to incorporate those sorts of things into mine also.
Do you have to run this by someone? It still makes me chuckle. We've had a number of SEALs on, and most recently, the story of Cairo, the heroic dog that was on the raid that got bin Laden. But they had to there's that SEAL team that everybody pretends doesn't exist, and we can't mention their name. But it's the worst kept secret in the world. Do you have to run your novels by someone for approval before you publish, or you clear that as well now?
Yeah, so I did that just to be safe. I was so close to it as I got out, and so I did submit. First one I got back, they say they'll get back to you in 30 days. First one I took 45, which I thought was pretty good. Second one they took 7 months. So not big readers over there at the Pentagon. And then the fourth one about the same, or the third one about the same. And what they took out, so if people are curious, the best example is the second novel, True Believer. So in the hardcover edition, there are 54 either passages or words or sentences that the government took out. So I appealed on that one and had my attorneys attach a publicly available government document. So you can just go online, not just find it online, but find it from the actual government, from the military, from Congress, wherever it is. And so we tied not just if it was in a Wikipedia or in someone else's book or anything like that, but no, publicly available government document to each one of those 54, and I won on 37. So if they then get the paperback, they can look and see which and they take out things that I just made up, completely made up, and they redacted things. And so I won on 37. So, it's fairly ridiculous, especially if you're doing it with fiction, but I just wanted to, be safe and honor my commitments and all that. But now I'm so far removed from all of that, if I do nonfiction at any point in time, I will submit that. But
sure,
going forward here on the fiction side of the house, it's probably a moot point.
Sure. Folks, Jack is in the middle of a virtual book tour for The Devil's Hand. It's convenient because he doesn't have to leave his palatial compound there in the mountains of Utah. You can check out the schedule and register to join the man himself by visiting officialjackcarr.com. When we come back, sometimes it's better to be lucky than good, and the setting of Jack's latest book, given what's happening in the world today, is going to intrigue you. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Ben Bueller Garcia. We're chatting with Jack Carr. You can learn more, visit officialjackcarr.com. No longer a Navy SEAL. He's now a writer who just happened to be a Navy SEAL, but I tell you what, he's a darn good writer. You'll enjoy his books. Jack, I was kind of teased before the break about it, better to be lucky than good. The timing of Devil's Hand relative to what's going on in the world today, I'm no Jack Carr, but I wrote a little piece for the Havoc Journal probably about a year ago. I called Weaponizing the Influencers, and in essence, it was like, if I wanted to bring down the nation's or the world's greatest superpower without firing a shot, what's happening right now with social media and the virus and all this stuff would be precisely the plan I would follow. Did you sort of start to get that vibe a little bit as you're finishing up The Devil's Hand and you're looking around outside of your compound there in Utah?
I certainly did, and I outlined the whole thing in August of 2019. So I got home from that trip, had this outline. The whole basis is what the enemy has learned by watching us on the field of battle for the last 20 years. So they've watched us in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, other hotspots around the world, and I wanted to put myself in their shoes. So if I was Iran, if I was China, if I was Russia, if I was North Korea, if I was a super empowered individual or a terrorist organization, what would I have learned and what would I have applied to future battle plans? So that's how it started. And then the catalyst was really a bioweapon. So I started looking into bioweapons and looking into the weaponization of infectious diseases and that history, particularly from the end of World War I up through today. So I was hypersensitive when COVID hit, and because of the basis of the novel, I knew that the enemy was learning something from our response to COVID. So I started weaving that in real time. And then we have a summer of civil unrest, and I thought, well, the enemy is certainly learning something from this. What is that? And then I incorporated that. Then I get to a very contentious political season and election cycle. Certainly the enemy is learning something there. And so I applied, wrote that into it. And then I ran into an issue because I was in about October, November timeframe, and I thought, geez, you know, I've been living this, going along this writing journey here, and if I was the enemy, I might just watch for a little while longer. We seem to be pretty good at, you know, destroying ourselves here from the inside. So I had to come up with something that would allow me to make it believable for them to strike now. So I had to solve that problem. And that's a great thing about writing is you're solving problems on the written page, kind of the same way I did on the battlefield. But, you know, if I mess it up here in a thriller, I can go back and edit it the next day. So the consequences aren't nearly as dire. So it's much less stressful.
Well, I'm pleased that you're saying that as you're doing your book tour, because as a civilian, you know, again, I'm not the brightest guy in the world, but I read history and I know the importance of reading history. And you and your 20 years in the teams, you know, you witnessed how our adversaries, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, they know they can't beat you in a straight up fight. So here come the, you know, they develop the IEDs. Kind of the same thing happening in our nation right now. And I just, I tell you, it chills me to the bone. We had G. Michael Hoff on the show a couple of years ago and, you know, talking about EMPs. And, man, after I talked to him, I want to go home and buy a solar generator and lots of ammunition and beans.
Oh, that's it. There's a great book called One Second After that does a great job describing societal breakdown and what happens. It's a thriller. It's fiction, but oh my gosh, it's such a fantastic novel. Highly recommend that one. One Second After, and it makes you want to do just that. It makes you want to make sure you're prepared for whatever might come our way, and that's what, you know, hopefully people have done over this last year is think back on what they felt like in March or April of last year and then make changes so they could be more prepared going forward in case, you know, whether it's a pandemic or a natural disaster or civil unrest or whatever it might be, so that when that time comes, when these things hit, that you can allocate your bandwidth towards solving the problems associated with each one of those things rather than what you know you're going to have to solve anyway, which is some of those basics, that food, that water, a firearm to protect your family, having the fire extinguishers in the house, having something where to filter water, make fire, like that sort of thing. So, and a financial foundation as well. I mean, a lot of people were worried about, you know, their jobs and that sort of thing. So making sure that enough money is put away that they give them that foundation to have a little bit of breathing room. And that's, of course, going to change and be different depending on what everyone is comfortable with and where they live and what their family situation is like.
Jack, I'm no expert, but I talk to a lot of experts, and I'm thinking as you're going through all the must-haves for that post-apocalyptic world, you know, an action guy like you should maybe get into something like, I don't know, tomahawks? Maybe you've ever thought about that?
I have one within reach right now. Actually, two within reach right now. So I'm quite the fan. I've always had this natural draw towards tomahawk because it's such a primal weapon, and that's why it gets incorporated into all the novels thus far.
Well, I'm just glad this is a phone interview then. At your website, you also have a list of recommended reading materials. And one thing I didn't notice on the list, Jack, and I don't know if you've ever, maybe you want to consider if you haven't read, have you ever read The Discourses and Selected Writings by Epictetus?
I have not.
You need to find that. It is...
I'm writing it down right now.
It's outstanding, and folks can learn. It's ancient, but there's a lot of knowledge in there. And
what
folks,
is it again?
It's called, just look up Epictetus, E-P-I-C-T-E-T-U-S. He's a Greek philosopher. And there's a.
I do. I have read that. It's been a long time, though. Sorry, I thought you were saying something else. So I do. It's about 10 feet away from me right now, behind in the bookshelves I have that go three deep that I'm looking at. So I have quite the collection. But it's been probably, gosh, 25 years, I'll say, since of that.
Well, we'll blame the tomahawks. You got distracted. Now, something is kind of an interesting dichotomy. For me, with you, Jack, one of your influencers, you consider David Morrell, the creator of Rambo. But you also talk a lot about something that is near and dear to my heart, and we've had several guests on to talk about this, Dale Dye, several other folks. This misconception that everybody that goes to war comes back damaged. And how do you, given the Rambo character in the context of that statement, just we need to recognize one's fantasy and one's reality, or what? How do you level the playing field in that situation?
Sure. No, I mean, people certainly can come back damaged physically and, you know, physically, mentally, spiritually, when they come back from traumatic experiences downrange. It doesn't even have to be downrange, traumatic experiences just in life in general. From Vietnam up through today, the Hollywood depiction of a soldier returning home has typically fit a certain narrative. Not all the time, but typically filled that narrative of damaged goods. And those who have gone downrange know is not necessarily true. So they've taken, you know, one thing that can happen to you, and they've made it really appear as the norm. And I mean, it is a good way to move storylines forward and that sort of thing, because people in stories, whether it's visual or the written word, need to be tested and need to overcome adversity and that sort of thing. That's what makes the story. So I see why it's used that way, but it certainly isn't everyone. That's for sure.
And you know, that's why I like your character, James Reese, because he seems one of those warriors that does have that internal switch. And there's just a powerful, there's one page I dog marked in the entire novel, and it's where he's talking about the first time he killed a man and how he felt about that. And that was so powerful. And we're just, as a civilian, Jack, I'm grateful there's sheepdogs out there like you and your comrades who were able to turn that switch on and off and not become damaged goods. But so when you're not out, you know, using a tomahawk on smashing zombie heads with the Black Rifle Coffee guys, what do you do in your spare time? Are you producing a major television series? Just a random guess.
Random question. Yeah. So in my spare time, that's what I'm doing. And actually, go back to your previous comment there. Someone reached out with that and mentioned that exact same passage that you just referenced, and said they were having such a hard time coming to grips with some of the things they did downrange, and they read that passage, and it was like lifting a weight. It was amazing that this person wrote me, and it just meant so much for me to hear that, that it actually, you know, helped somebody. But anyway, yes, right now, working on executive producer on the Terminal List series, which is coming to Amazon, I think sometime in 2022. I'm not positive about that, but filming it right now, and Chris Pratt is starring as James Reese, Navy SEAL sniper, my protagonist, and he's an amazing guy, and he is crushing it. I was on set all last week, and he is just doing such an amazing job. And
I've never heard of him. Who's Chris Pratt?
Are you serious? You've never heard of Chris Pratt?
Well, because he hasn't been on American Warrior Radio yet. You might want to mention that.
There you go.
I did. I do want to say there's. I know you're already filming now, so it might be too late. But you know, I was bugging your agent. I said, hey, maybe you know Jack can get me a role in the movie, and he basically said, yeah, Ben, you'd be good at playing a corpse. So that ended that discussion. But there is a guy named Jeff Bosley. He is a former Green Beret medic on the cast of CBS SEAL Team. You know, they wore your hats in the series. Call Jeff. Get Jeff in there. He's a mountain of a man. He'd be perfect.
Oh, yeah. I passed on all his info to everybody. So they're well aware of him. So it's crazy how they actually cast almost last second for some of these things, for some of these episodes. That was quite surprising to me because I thought, what if someone just did a role where they had to be, you know, be extremely overweight or, you know, whatever else, like sometimes these actors do to really get into these roles. And then they get all of a sudden picked to do something like this and they have to get back in shape in a week or something like that. So that's been surprising to me, just how last minute some of the casting is. But I guess that's life in Hollywood. That's how it goes.
Folks, when we come back, we're going to talk more about lessons the rest of us can learn from Jack Carr and his experiences in his career. Don't forget to visit officialjackcarr.com. There's a schedule of virtual book signings, if you will, a virtual tour he's doing right now. You'll enjoy that. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Dula Garcia. Very pleased to be chatting with Jack Carr. Jack, thanks so much for spending an hour with our listeners today. And a lot I want to cover, one of which, though, I always try and learn. I mean, and you know, I want to be a lifelong learner. And so I'm exploring Jack Carr on your website, and I'm trying to figure out, and one of the best tips I found for a guy like me that's trying to, you know, get my little show out of his parents' garage, don't post stupid things.
That is good. It's good advice. and unfortunately, I mean, some people, that's what they do, and some people like that. And that's what's wonderful about choices and options. So for me, though, I look at it as, hey, people have trusted me with their time, whether they're reading the book or they're listening to it on audio, which is quite popular, read by Ray Porter, who's just an amazing narrator, or it's a post that I do on social media. So I put just as much thought into those posts as I do to a paragraph in the novel or anything that I do, because we're only on this planet for a certain amount of time. You don't know if it's going to end tomorrow or in a year or in 10 years. You just don't know. And so you only have this limited amount of time, and you get to choose how you're going to spend that time and how you're going to influence those around you. So what I try to do is add value to people's day with the writing and the novels, and then even with the social media posts. And for me, I look at social media as a way to be able to say thank you to people who take a risk on me as a new author and then tell a friend, because that really allows me to do what I love to do, which is the writing part. So it's really about adding something of value to someone's day. So I do put a lot of thought, energy, and effort into that.
Well, Jack, I tell you, me and lots of other content creators out there should take inspiration from your story. In the absence of direction on the battlefield, take over and lead. You had no accounts, no followers, no agent, but you say never pay attention to the odds. And, man, you just kicked that door in, and it's all looking back now, right? Well, for a little while.
Well, I'm not looking back. I'm looking forward. I'm in a full-on sprint right now through Book Launch Week, and that's definitely I haven't taken the time to take a breath really since all this started. So I'm always learning, always adapting, always trying to do it better, just like on the battlefield, looking for gaps, looking ways to capitalize on momentum, that sort of thing, because really it's not just writing, which I thought at the beginning. I thought you could just go to the mountains, live in a cabin, write a book, send it to New York, and start your next one. And I didn't realize that you had to do everything that you're going to do with any business, whether it's a coffee shop or whatever it might be. You have to do all those other things, those budgets, the marketing, the advertising, the engagement, the social media side of the house. You have to do all of that in order to build a readership. So that was something I didn't expect, but I love learning new things. And what I really like about social media is being able to engage with people and say thank you. So you couldn't have done that 30 years ago as an author. So that's why I have a podcast called Danger Close, Beyond the Books with Jack Carr. Those drop every Wednesday. That's something an author couldn't have done in 1965, 75, 85, 95. So I look at all these new platforms out there as things that, as an author, I can do to build that readership and really let everybody know how grateful I am that they took a risk on me.
Jack, I mentioned better to be lucky than good. You got just a tremendous hand up from a Norse god named Brad Thor when you started your career. But G. Michael Hoff offers to mentor other veteran authors. Have you considered doing that, or are you doing that already?
I think I do that every day through those posts, that engagement, and just how I live, I guess. So that's probably the best way to do it. People can jump on, they can see what you're doing, how you're doing it. They can take what's useful, discard what's useful. They can make it their own as they continue down their path. Everyone's path is different. But what you need to do, what remains the same for everyone, is that we all have to do the work. So that when someone cracks that door, when someone offers that helping hand up, whatever it might be, that you are ready. You've done that work at this base level to build this foundation that allows you to then kick that door in. Because if you haven't done the work, then, well, it's not going to happen when somebody cracks that door. You're not prepared. You're not ready to go. You're not ready to seize that opportunity that's been presented. So regardless, you have to do that work at that base level. That's the constant.
Jack, talk about giving back. In December, you launched the Jack Carr collection of merchandise. Folks can find that at officialjackcarr.com. 100% of those proceeds go to veteran charities. Eli Crane won't take me shooting. Maybe you will someday. But tell us about the Rescue 22 Foundation real quick. We've got about 4 minutes.
Yeah, so what a great foundation started by a friend of mine, and I just heard them on your program here during that commercial break. So thank you so much for getting the word out about them. But they train up, they fully train
service and support dogs for those who have gone downrange and are suffering from some of those physical and emotional traumas of the battlefield. And having a service and support dog has just been proven to be so helpful in assisting these veterans as they move forward in life. So whatever that is between, a man and his dog, I guess that's a real bond. That's a real thing. And so Rescue 22, they do an amazing job getting these to the right veterans out there. Of course, it takes a lot of work training up one of these dogs. It takes a lot of time, energy, and effort from these guys. And so they, their volume is small, but the dogs, the quality is just so high. And it's amazing to see, so I'm proud to be associated with them.
Well, I'd love that you're giving 100%. You're not taking any off the top on this. You're giving 100% of the proceeds from these sales, and you must be doing pretty good. I went there, and almost everything sold out. I mean, folks might have to come get an American Warrior Radio bottle breacher until you restock.
That's it, until I restock. Yeah, it's supposed to be launching again here soon, but I didn't realize how big it was going to be, and we couldn't meet demand. It was just me and my wife stuffing envelopes and packages and getting things off, and she's dealing with the customer service side, and, we thought we'd sell a few T-shirts here and there because people were asking, but I also brought in some curated things that are a lot different than just kind of a normal, maybe, an author might put up their hat, T-shirt, sweatshirt, that sort of thing. A lot of veteran-owned businesses, Direct Action USA, that makes these awesome bookmarks, handmade by veterans, that have a 5.56 round attached to them. Of course, I have the Eli Crane stuff in there, former SEAL. So I have a lot of cool things on that are unique in the space, I should say. But because we couldn't meet demand, we just decided to outsource that this year. So we're trying to figure out how to do that through a fulfillment center because we just couldn't meet that demand. So it's a good problem to have, though.
Yeah, absolutely. First world problems. Jack, we're running out of time, but one thing also struck me just real quick. When you read your character in your books and you follow you on your website and your lifestyle, I mean, your daughter got her first deer, I think, at the age of 7. How important is it for the average American out there, if they get out of the cities, to just learn to be more self-sufficient today and witnessing what we're witnessing now across the country? Just how strongly do you feel about communicating that and helping folks get to that point?
Yeah, there's just such a disconnect between people these days and where their food comes from the land. And there's so much to be said about going out, going into the backcountry, putting down the phones. That's probably the most important part, is leaving the iPad, leaving the phone, leaving the Nintendo Switch behind, and getting out there in a deer stand with your kids. They get to be part of that process. They get to put food on the family's table. You get to relive that experience with them while you're making that meal. And it teaches them responsibility with firearms, self-reliance. They're more connected to the land and connected to you because your head's not your phone either, returning a text or whatever it might be. So getting outside with the kids, and there's something about hunting that is a little different than just going on a hike, because you're part of that world, you're part of that natural world, you're part of that life cycle. You're not just an observer, you're a participant in it, and you're learning, the kids are learning where that food comes from. They're learning it doesn't just magically appear on the shelves at grocery stores, and then they have more respect for it and all the work and effort that goes in to putting food on the table.
Jack, thank you so much for spending time with us, and congratulations on your success. Very hard-earned, and I hope that maybe someday we'll talk you down the line again when you make another major motion picture.
Oh, that sounds great. No,
don't forget,
so
I can play a corpse.
I sincerely appreciate it.
All right, take care, Jack. Ladies and gentlemen, you can learn more. He's doing a virtual tour right now. Visit officialjackcarr.com, C-A-R-R. You can buy some of that very cool merchandise, tomahawks, maybe, included, to support these veterans' charities. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.